The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. I've got Jim back on the show. He made it safely back from Ohio, and I've got a slew of questions built up. We're on some tax topics last couple of shows, so hopefully you got some benefit out of that. And actually, we're going to have to deal with a little more tax issues right off the bat here because we're getting a little whiplash back and forth as Congress negotiates, maybe is the right word, what's going to go into this Build Back Better bill or act here of 2021. Looks like it's going to be passed in some form here in 2021. But Jim, welcome back to the show. Hello. There you are. Not ready
to
talk.
Can you hear me? Okay. Yeah. So I was trying to you can unmute me. Thank you.
Oh, I can, yeah.
I was on the IRS's website looking up something, and then when you mentioned my name out of the blue, I thought I had time.
I was worried there for a second. There was dead silence.
Well, I was trying to find the unmute button because I got to click some stuff on my computer. And anyways, you surprised me with how quickly you threw it to me.
I got you taken care of. I can unmute you from here, remote style.
I didn't realize that. Glad I wasn't cussing.
True.
yes, I am back. I got back, folks. Goodness, when did I get back, Chris? Tuesday or Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was Tuesday evening. Just about dark, I got back to Colorado. It's good to be home. I never felt comfortable staying in an Airbnb for 3 weeks. Even though I had the place to myself, I just never really felt.
Were you gone for 3 weeks?
Counting the driving, yes, 3 weeks.
Wow.
You didn't notice? You didn't miss me?
I didn't want to say it like that, but I didn't realize. I didn't realize you were that missing for so long.
Well, thank you for missing me.
No, it's a testament to your, getting the firm prepared for your frequent now departures.
Well, but the other thing is it was not a non-working trip. I was working every day, talking to you guys on the phone. As you pointed out, it's no different me being in my home 45 minutes south of Fort Collins or in Kentucky or Ohio, 18 hours east of Fort Collins. Yeah. I'm still not in the office, but it was a working trip. So that's probably why you didn't miss me as much. I would hope that's why you didn't miss me as much.
Yeah, things went quite smoothly.
Well, everything's fine. I'm back to a bunch of leaves on the ground, so I am enjoying being out there and cleaning up the yard in the fall, my favorite time of year. But it's nice to be home, people, and I'll bring everybody up to date.
You still there?
Oh, I'm sorry. I hit the mute button by mistake.
Not only am I going to control your mute button remotely, I'm going to take away your control.
No. Keep letting me mute because sometimes I have to cough. But I hit the little mouse pad on my iPad. Uh-huh. I mean, on my
iPad. And the mouse was sitting over the mute button.
Yes. Yeah. And I just lightly hit it, but it was enough to... mute myself. I kept talking until I heard you say
this show's
hello.
Starting out perfect.
It's starting out really good. But anyways, folks, this is a Q&A show, so we're going to jump into the Q's with the A's. But before we do that, we want to bring everybody up to date because it's like whiplash going on here with the BBBA. It does not look like the administration is going to pass what they wanted to. They keep trying to whittle it down, refinangle it. And there's things that are in, then out, then back in. So we just want to give a little brief update. Do you want to begin with your update? Do you want me to begin with my update, Chris?
Well, I think they're one and the same.
They're one and the same. We're going to talk about similar things. So the big thing to keep in mind, folks, the inability to convert after-tax dollars in an IRA to a Roth IRA were part of the original BBBA. Then recently, when they refinangled it from a $3.5 trillion spending thing to a $1.75 trillion spending thing, they removed that. And they removed it for a whopping, what was it, Chris, 2 days, 3 days?
Yeah. Just enough time for us to announce on the last show with Bob that they had removed these things, and some are back.
So the inability to convert after-tax IRA and 401k money to a Roth as right now are still in. They were out, then they're in, then they're back in, and they're here, but we don't know what the final bill is going to be. The big thing, Chris, and I want you to know, we've mentioned this a few times on the podcast, I don't feel this bill, if it even is going to pass, will not happen until sometime in December. They only have, I think, 8 days after this week, after today. I think they have 8 days before they break for Turkey Day, Chris. Mm-hmm. So most likely, by time they get back, nothing will happen until December if this thing is going to pass or not. Meaning if that inability to convert after-tax contributions remains, Chris and I still feel, and we're steadfast on this, the custodians will not have enough time the last 2-3 weeks of December, or maybe the last 1 week of December, if this doesn't pass and get signed until after Christmas, there won't be enough time to rush and convert after-tax dollars. If you have after-tax dollars in an IRA or a 401k, and your plan was to always convert it to a Roth, you may want to consider doing it now if you have the ability. You may not have the ability if you're still working and you can't access the money in the 401k. But if you have the ability to do it, you may want to do it. If you are one who normally does a backdoor Roth contribution, but you wait until the following year, you know how you can make IRA contributions, Chris, up to April 15th or the tax filing deadline of that previous year. Mm-hmm. So if you normally wait and do it in March or April when your taxes are done, it might be too late. You might want to do it this year before the end of the year. Anyways, our advice on that has not changed. It's just too uncertain if it's going to be in or not. Our advice on everything else and why we went to great lengths when we tried to talk to you about grantor trusts and how islets might be affected, I think we said half a dozen times on that show, Chris, don't do anything right now.
Yeah, wait and see what happens.
Wait and see. And why is that important?
Well, we're seeing it illustrated in grand detail here where it's just back and forth and back and forth and things that are in there for a while, suddenly get ripped out overnight. And in this case, certain things we talked about left and came back in a very, very short time, might go away again, might come back.
Exactly.
More stuff might come back. They might throw something brand new we haven't heard about in there still. All this stuff is, we call it the sausage making, right? The final sausage isn't for sale yet. It's messy, the making phase. So we like to keep an eye on it so we know, you know, what's going on, so things hopefully don't hit us by total surprise. But as far as acting on a lot of the stuff, it's very, very precarious, I think, to act upon things that are proposed or in the bill for a while when it's in this negotiating sausage-making phase.
Exactly, because in the latest iteration of the BBBA, all of those items that pertain to grantor trusts have been removed. Mm-hmm. So all of that manipulation, talk about loopholes, all of the manipulation that very wealthy people do with grantor trusts on how they can, quote unquote, sell something they own to their own grantor trust and theoretically give up access and control to it, while everybody knows they retain near full access and control of it, and the sale is not taxable and the money that they receive is not considered a gain, all those games, Chris, are back in. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be cut. And remember I said that when we did that show a couple of weeks ago. I said there are too many uber wealthy people. I'm not talking people with 10, 15, 20 million. I'm talking people with 150, 200, 300, 400, 500 million or a billion or more. These big time players who contribute to senators and presidents and political parties. I said they're not going to want to give that up. That's how they get all their money nearly tax free and get it out of their estate. And sure enough, it's out. Will it be put back in? Who knows? I don't think the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which is pushing for a lot of these tax changes, is going to be able to succeed in getting that in. And right now, the attack on grantor trusts, including IDGETs, intentionally defective grantor trusts, the best acronym Chris and I love, we love that acronym, that's the best one, IDGET. Are back on the table, and well, back on the table in the sense, Chris, they're not going to be changed. Right. They're back into play for uber wealthy people to do some phenomenal tax advantage estate planning. Where it matters to everybody listening to this podcast, especially those in states that impose their own estate tax, ILITs, irrevocable life insurance trusts, which are often structured as grantor trusts, are back in play. So that's why we told you during that show not to rush out and make any changes. So I did want to mention that. One other thing that I'll mention, and then we're going to questions, and this one is something you got to watch. Chris, do we like trusts as beneficiaries of IRAs?
No is the simple answer. In certain circumstances, one might make an argument for considering them. Let me say it like that. It's not impossible that it were to make sense in a specific circumstance, but as a general rule, bad idea.
Correct. Chris and I are not fans, but he is 100% correct. There are certain situations, especially with special needs planning, if you have a child with special needs, or if you have a child with a drug problem or a spendthrift problem. But outside of those narrow circumstances, we are not fans of IRAs being named as beneficiaries of trusts. And the reason is, folks, the money
around.
In your...
Just to be clear.
Say
trust names
say
as,
what?
Named as beneficiaries of IRAs.
Oh, did I say it backwards?
Yeah,
whatever.
It's okay.
It's not what I say. It's what I mean. Mm-hmm. So one of the things to keep in mind, folks, your IRA is considered income. I say that all the time. You see assets, the IRS sees income. In the new BBBA, there are two surtaxes now that they want to impose on people earning $10 million or $25 million or more of income. So at first blush, Chris, it seems like they're going after the uber, you know, 0.05% of the population, because who earns 10 or 25 million? So what they want to do, they put a 5% surtax on your taxes if you have gross income over 10 million, and an additional 3% surtax if your gross income exceeds 25 million, for a total 8% surtax on top of, with those income amounts, Chris, they'll be in the highest tax bracket, which right now under this bill would be 39.6. Let's call it 40. I hate 39.6. Call it 40%. Mm-hmm. Add another 8. You're looking at about 48% federal tax plus state and local. The problem is, folks, the limits for a trust to trigger these amounts. 200,000 to trigger the 5% surtax. Now, you might say, I don't have a trust that's going to earn 200,000 of income. And I agree, you would have to have millions of dollars in there to generate 200,000 of interest or dividend income, especially in these low income tax environments, interest rate environments, Chris. But what if you leave, folks, a $200,000 IRA to a trust for the benefit of your children, and that trust holds the income, which we're not fans of? There you just hit the $200,000, because money from your IRA is considered income, not an asset. What if you left a $2 million IRA and the beneficiary of the IRA is a trust, and that trust is going to hold the assets for your special needs child or your spendthrift child, or just hold your assets for some bizarre reason you want it to be held? It could easily trigger this surtax. You follow what I'm saying? Because only $200,000. You have to close the IRA, Chris, within 10 years. What if the trustee took $200,000 out a year for 10 years? Each year, the 5% surtax on top of the highest tax bracket, folks.
Right.
Trusts are taxed at the highest marginal rate after receiving, I think it's $13,500. I forget what the exact number is, but it's very low. I think it's $13,500. They pay the highest taxes. So if the highest tax rate is 39.6, I'm rounding up to 40, is 40, and it receives, the trust receives more than $200,000, it's now going to be 45. And if the trust receives more than $500,000, it's now 48. So you can see 40 to nearly 50% of your IRA is going to be lost because of the trust. Now, if the trust just passes the money straight on to your children and doesn't hold it, no harm, no foul. But my question would then be, why did you create the trust to begin with?
Right, exactly.
So anyways, I do want to make mention that this surtax sounds like they're only going after the uber wealthy. This is going to hit our listeners a lot, Chris, if they're naming trusts as beneficiaries of their IRAs and naming it and to, for the trust to hold the money to protect and control it. We have a lot of listeners out there who have $2, $3, $4 million IRAs, and they could lose a substantial amount of the money in their IRAs to trust taxation. Mm-hmm. All right. That's all I want to say. Let's jump into some questions.
Just to let people know, they're talking about, they've brought back the idea of raising the SALT, the state and local tax deductibility limits, too. So that's in play again as well. So just, we don't need to talk about it any more than that. But just since we're doing the whiplash back and forth tracking Congress, we thought we'd throw that one in there, too, because a lot of people pay attention to that.
Correct. And again, if you have after-tax dollars, you might still want to consider converting them if you're able to before the end of the year. I'm not convinced that provision isn't going to make it. Okay. I believe, Chris, you got the first Social Security question.
I do. I have a quick one right up top here we should deal with. So, just came in today, so hot off the presses. I meant actually to mention it last week and didn't, so I'm glad I got this. So the email simply says, Chris, has last year's concern of a potential negative average wage index for workers born in 1960 due to many job losses from COVID in 2020 proven unfounded? The following Social Security link indicates the 2020 average wage index will be positive 2.83% for 2020. Yes, it's gone. And if you remember us talking about it all last year, let me recap what it is very quickly. There was this threat or possibility due to the strange nature of the year 2020, right? With all the people unemployed, et cetera, that there was, it was going to cause havoc for the wage inflation measures for the year. And wage inflation affects how your Social Security benefit is calculated. And due to the way this is calculated, I'm not going to go into all the details on this show. It had a potential adverse effect on people that were specifically born in 1960. In other words, those turning 62 in 2022. And of course, the financial planning retail media took this and ran with it and caused all kind, you know, talk about a good headline, right? It's a clickbait where they were making this huge deal about those born in 1960 were going to be unfairly hammered by this negative effect on their Social Security that would be a permanent negative effect for the rest of their lives. I, over time, even when it first came out, said this is likely overblown. Let's just, you know, watch this. There's plenty of time for this to be, quote, fixed if it does become an issue. Later on, Social Security essentially responded to a question from Congress about this, and they replied that, you know, looks like it's not going to be nearly as bad as people thought it might be. The official number has come out, and no, there is no negative wage inflation, which was the fear for 2020. Turns out the number is positive, 2.8%. So the simple answer is, has it proven unfounded? Yes, it has proven unfounded. There is no great harm being done to those born in 1960 for their Social Security benefits. So would it have been better had this number been higher than 2.8? Yes, but that's true in any year. You benefit from these numbers being higher. You benefit in the form of higher Social Security benefit calculations. So all that, you know, if you've been listening to the show for a while, I'm sure you heard us talk about it. If you follow any of the typical places where there's articles or blog posts posted on things related to Social Security, I'm sure you saw it because it was like the hot thing all summer long in 2020. It was blasted everywhere. Totally overblown. So no need to worry on that particular topic. One less thing to worry about in retirement, I guess. I like to point those out because there's plenty to worry about. Here's one less thing.
Okay, well, this next question, Chris, is kind of related to what you talked about, not necessarily the main item, but what you were mentioning with the COLA. So this gentleman wrote to us. It's not really a question. I think he just wanted to vent and also get our opinion on things. But I thought what he's venting about is something that our listeners might, well, they probably already realize it. This will just drill it home. Mm-hmm. So he writes, my Part D Social Security is going to go up by $80 next year. I want to pause there. I think he means Medicare Part D is going to go up by $80. Not his Social Security. It says on Social Security, my Part D. I think he meant to say on Medicare, my Part D is right. Going to go up $80 next year. And no doubt, my Medicare supplemental plan will also rise. We'll talk on future shows, listeners, what he's talking about, Medicare supplemental plans. We're not going to get into that now. We actually have a Medicare person that we've been speaking with. Chris and I met with her yesterday, and I believe she's going to be coming on the show and doing some Medicare shows on quite a regular basis, hopefully. So once we can get that all set up, we're going to start bringing her on. And she can get into a lot of what this person who is clearly on Medicare is dealing with, folks. But he continues. even though he's not certain yet, he says, my Medicare supplemental plan will likely also rise. So the increase we are going to get may not even cover these two increases. So pretty much my standard of living will actually decrease even though my income is increasing. Mm-hmm. And then he goes on to say, Chris, my house insurance is going to go up by over $100 next year. Have you been to a grocery store lately? This is not looking good for retirees. And then he says, what is your opinion? Thanks for your podcast. And he signs his name. So what is your opinion on what he's sharing as far as what he's experiencing as a retiree who clearly is living on fixed income with his Social Security playing a very important part in the funding of his retirement, or at least that's the impression I'm getting.
Something, the typical story, actually, complaint that a lot of retirees have, that their actual standard of living, that a certain Social Security benefit would support, the standard of living declines, even though they're getting cost of living adjustments. This is one argument for using maybe a different inflation measure to determine cost of living adjustments for Social Security that's more reflective of retirees' spending and retirees' consumption basket, we would call it, is a bit different than the average overall worker's consumption basket, which is the basket of goods and services that they use to measure prices on year to year to determine how inflation is affecting people. The CPIW that's used to apply Social Security cost of living adjustments is not retiree specific, or not Social Security aged people specific. It's average workers in the United States. So one argument is that measure has always or typically underestimates the true inflation that people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s are facing, because older people tend to have a higher proportion of in their consumption basket of medical expenses in particular compared to a younger person. And medical, as we know, goes up much faster than average inflation. At least it has for quite some time now. So there is that issue. There's also, be aware, this isn't going to always fix or protect the standard of living for every individual person. They're using average baskets here, and if your basket of goods and services is different than average, you're consistently going to either under or overperform on the adjustments on inflation. So it isn't surprising that your specific circumstances aren't tracking perfectly with it, and absolutely, even though we have this historically large, right, 5.9% cost of living adjustment that's being applied to Social Security coming up here in 2022, big number, bigger number than we've seen in a very long time. He's describing a situation where even that isn't going to be enough to maintain his current standard of living, because that's a pretty large increase in his Part D premium. We'll talk about specifically what's typical in that when we have the Medicare specialist on here. But that's a big increase in a Part D premium. I suspect it's because the medication mix on that has changed. It isn't simply the plan, but it's possible. That is certainly possible. We haven't seen what the Part B premium is estimated. We haven't seen the final numbers, but is estimated to go up about $10 per month for 2022. So that, just keep that on your radar. Once we have a hard number from Social Security Administration announcing that, we'll certainly let you know, but it's modest. So we'll add that to his scenario. So $80 on Part D, $10 on his Part B premium that's going to go up. And then he mentioned he has a Medigap or supplemental plan. Who knows? Those are more specific to his area, so that's not going to be a universal figure there. But he's describing a situation where just on the medical side, the premium side, he's going up significantly, at least $90-$100 a month or more. And then he mentioned a couple of other lifestyle expenses, like his homeowner's insurance, that's going to go up a pretty significant amount. And if his Social Security benefit isn't large, that 5.9% increase they're going to apply isn't going to be enough to keep him there. So some people might suggest, and I guess he's wanting my thoughts and opinions on it, I do think it's worth considering at the congressional level of, you know, what measure is appropriate for use for cost of living adjustments for Social Security. And the Department of Labor has been tracking for quite a while now another CPI measure called CPIE, meant for kind of elderly age group instead. But something fascinating for this last year, the CPIW was 5.9, the CPIE was only 4.8%. So this particular year, you would actually, as a retiree on Social Security, have done worse with a cost of living adjustment than what they're currently using. So that may or may not be ultimately the, quote, solution to some of this. More often than not, the CPIE is higher. But the CPIE, if we look back at the history compared to CPIW that they use now for Social Security cost of living adjustments, historically, the E version has been a bit higher, and that's been the argument by those wanting to help protect seniors from this effect, that maybe we should consider using that instead. But it isn't always going to protect you better. Here's a classic case where the year is noticeably lower, a full percentage and 1.1 percentage points lower in that. So is there a, quote, solution? Well, everyone's going to be a bit unique, and I think relying on just Social Security cost of living adjustments won't be enough. There's always going to be the need for additional resources if you truly want to protect your standard of living, and resources that'll keep better pace with inflation. So that's always out there. It's tough to do that, though, without a certain level of risk. So everyone's going to have to take their appropriate planning into consideration and their risk tolerance and things like that. But this is a classic struggle for retirees, which is maintaining the standard of living over time as prices go up. When you're working, most of the time, not always, most of the time you're getting raises at work that are going to help maintain or even increase your standard of living over time. You know, if you actually move up in your career, you actually increase your standard of living while working. But in retirement, things are harder unless you've amassed sufficient resources to absorb this, which not everyone can do or has done. So there's not a simple solution to this. The problem definitely exists. He's describing a perfect case where he's probably right. His standard of living is going to go down a little bit next month or next year. I don't have an easy answer for him as far as how to undo that or protect himself against that. I don't know anything about the rest of his situation, too. He might have plenty of other resources, and he's just pointing this out. Or if he's living almost completely on Social Security, it's going to be tough, and he's going to have to find a way to cut other things, unfortunately.
Perfect. All righty. Now we have some non-Social Security questions, Chris. Two of them, I'm going to jump these to the top of the line. They came in over the last few weeks as we started doing these shows on BBBA. I still hate that acronym. I can't say it. I got to go BBBA. Anyways, so I'm going to kind of jump these to the top of the line. Hopefully people don't mind because they're a little bit more applicable to what is going on right now. So this first one is a long email. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he's got quite the strategy going on here. Okay. All righty. Where should I begin? Let me just explain then, rather than reading all of this. This is a listener, folks. He is from, I always like to say where people are from. He doesn't say. He does give me his real name. We're going to call him Joy. Actually, it's a female. Gives us her real name. But she asked to be called Georgette, so we will honor that. And she has a unique situation, Chris. So let me explain it to her. Every year, she does the backdoor contribution. Capiche on that?
Mm-hmm.
She does $7,000. She does not have any existing IRAs. So she can easily do it without any worry of the pro rata rule. Do you agree?
Sounds good so far.
Perfect. Over the years, she has been putting after-tax money into her 401k. Mm-hmm. Her intent when she, I guess when she stopped working, would be to move that money into a Roth IRA and move the earnings and her pre-tax contributions and the earnings associated with those contributions and the employer matches, all the money that hasn't been taxed, Chris, into her IRA. Mm-hmm. But because of the BBBA, she's starting to get a little bit worried.
Mm-hmm.
So she contacted her custodian. The custodian of her plan is Fidelity. Fidelity doesn't make the rules, folks. The 401k does. So if you have Fidelity as a custodian, you may or may not be able to do what this woman is eligible to do. So do keep that in mind. Fidelity informed her, Chris, that her plan would allow her, even though she's still working, to move once a year. They don't allow it more than once a year. She can move her after-tax voluntary contributions to a Roth, and all the growth associated with those after-tax contributions to an IRA. So she could do it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the problem, though, and she quickly figured this out. Do you know what the problem's going to be?
Yep, she's going to start filling an IRA with deferrals that would result in a pro rata rule if she does future backdoors, which may not be worth worrying about because the back door might be shut. But that's we're waiting
correct.
To see on that. But that's the issue that she's headed towards, correct?
Correct. That's what she was getting at. So let's just put some hypothetical dollar amounts in here, folks, so y'all can follow what this woman's doing. Every year she puts $7,000 into a non-deductible IRA, which anybody can contribute to. She makes too much money to contribute outright to a Roth IRA. So she puts $7,000 into a non-deductible IRA, and then I hope immediately, because you don't have to wait, immediately converts that after-tax money into a Roth IRA. Chris, what does she owe in taxes?
Zero. She's already paid. I mean, she did already pay taxes, but no additional right. taxes for that second step.
Mm-hmm. No additional taxes because, as Chris already pointed out, it's after-tax money. The only money that can go into a Roth, folks, is after-tax money. So there's no additional taxes are going to be owed. Why? She does not have any IRAs. Let's change the math up a little, Chris. Let's say she had a IRA with $93,000 in it, and she put $7,000 in a non-deductible IRA, meaning 7% of her IRA balance is post-tax, and 93% is pre-tax, and she went and just converted that $7,000 post-tax. What would have happened if that was her case?
If she just converted the post-tax?
Well, it's going to come out pro rata. What if she just converted that Roth? Right. What do you mean by that? I just want you to explain to our listeners what you mean.
It's well, you can't pro-rata. Just, once it's in the IRA like that, it's going to come out pro rata. You, in proportion to the pre-tax and after-tax designation or classification of those dollars that are inside there. So she can't just target the after-tax and convert it. It's going to come out proportionally 93%, 7% over to the Roth. So she's going to have a taxable conversion event at that point, which is not what she would have liked to do. Although she, this is a hypothetical we're describing here. That's not what she has talked about having
correct.
Done.
Mm-hmm. But that's what she's worried. So I just want our listeners, especially new listeners, to follow the logic here. Even if she kept that $7,000 totally separate in a separate IRA and just earmarked that $7,000, that's all after-tax money, the IRS would say you owe income taxes on 93% of that $7,000, and 7% of that $7,000 would be a tax-free Roth conversion. She wants to avoid that. If she does what Fidelity has offered to her, and she does not give dollar amounts, so I just don't know what the dollar amounts are. If she does what Fidelity said she can do, move the after-tax money in her Roth to a Roth 401k to a Roth IRA, she can do it once a year. She's got 2 months to do it. move it to a Roth IRA, and Fidelity will simultaneously move the growth or pre-tax money, Chris, associated with that after-tax money to an IRA. She will end up having money in an IRA. So let's try to keep simple math here again,
Chris.
Let
me fix one thing for people who are listening very closely. What Jim meant to say was the after-tax money in the traditional 401k, if she's allowed to roll that out to the Roth IRA, but the attached earnings to that are going to come out as well and go to a traditional IRA. If she converts from the Roth 401k out, there is no coming, you know, earnings coming along with it. That would be convertible out to a Roth IRA cleanly. You said Roth 401k when you described that, Jim.
Oh, I'm sorry. No. She doesn't have a Roth 401k. It's not what I say. It's what I mean. Yeah. Thanks for picking that up, Chris. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, folks, I have had a stroke. So I don't think clearly sometimes. All right. Again, follow our logic. Let's just say, Chris, there is going to be $23,000 of growth associated with all those years of after-tax voluntary contributions to her traditional 401k. Mm-hmm. So now she has an IRA with $23,000 in it, folks, that has never been taxed. All her other monies, and it doesn't matter how much it is. It could be $500,000, doesn't matter what it is. All the post-tax voluntary contributions are safely in her Roth, tax-free, but she has an IRA now in my hypothetical example with $23,000 in it. She did a backdoor, Chris, with $7,000. So now her backdoor would be taxable.
Right.
Do you understand how that happens? Well, I know you do. Why don't you explain to our listeners with those dollar amounts what would happen?
Yeah, so now she's got an issue where she has before tax money in a traditional IRA, which the IRS is going to look to when calculating any potential pro rata rule that was happening with any conversions from traditional IRA to Roth IRA that she was doing. So that backdoor technique is blown up. And as long as that before tax money is sitting in that traditional IRA moving forward, it's going to contaminate the ability to do a clean backdoor contribution. That's what she's facing. I have a couple of ideas related to that, but I don't know if you have other things you want to
deal with here first. I'm just laying the groundwork. So you've got a calculator with it because I know you do. Mm-hmm. I've been in your office.
Yep.
So just so new people understand, if she all at the end of the year, because the IRS looks on December 31st, folks, at all your IRAs. So on December 31st, and the IRS knows what you have in your IRA on December 31st because custodians have to report it to the IRS by May 15th or May 30th of the following year. So they're going to know. So they're going to see $23,000 in an IRA, and they're going to see a $7,000 backdoor being done. And if she doesn't do her taxes right and says, hey, I don't owe any taxes, they're going to nail her. So how much would she owe? What percent of that conversion? If there's $30,000 total, the $7,000 that was put in and converted, and the $23,000 that's still there on 12/31, what would that taxation of the $7,000 look like?
So 23% of it is going to be considered after tax, no taxation. So 76% of that $7,000 conversion is going to be considered a taxable conversion.
Correct. So she wrote and said, this is my conundrum. Mm-hmm. And then she answered her own question.
I hope it's what I was going to suggest.
She said, I got back on the horn to Fidelity and asked if I can move an IRA into my 401k.
I love our listeners.
And Fidelity said yes. And then she asked Fidelity, can she do this or would it blow up the back door? And they said, we don't give tax advice. We're not going to answer that. So she came to us.
Yeah.
The good news is, listener, It will work.
Yep.
The IRS is going to look at December 31st to figure out the pro rata calculation on any backdoor that anybody's doing, backdoor IRA, that anybody is doing. If you can get this all done in 2 months, sounds like plenty of time, but don't forget, listener, you've got two major holidays in the middle of those 2 months. And if the BBBA passes, you might have custodians inundated with paperwork. Most custodians, as you and I have said, Chris, will tell people anytime, usually by December 15th, but between December 1st and December 15th, custodians will start issuing notices that they cannot guarantee any work will be done by the end of the year if you submit it after whatever their deadline is. I generally see it anywhere between December 1st and December 15th. I have no idea what your Fidelity custodial person or company will impose on that particular 401k. So the point is, listener, even though you got 2 months, you might only have about a month. So you could do it. If you can get this all done, get the money into your IRA, and then get it moved back to the 401k, which they've told you you could do, as long as you have a zero IRA balance by 12/31, you're okay. If you think you're going to be wise and say, oop, I can't get this money moved to my 401k in time, I'm just going to take it out of my IRA as a rollover and have a zero balance on 12/31, put it back into my IRA in January, and then move it to my 401k, that will not work. You have to add not only the balance of your IRAs on 12/31, you have to add any outstanding rollovers that have not been completely rolled over. So that little trick won't work. People do that trick all the time and they get nailed. So I just wanted to mention that's not going to work. Yeah. All right. Anything else you want to add on that?
No, I guess I would make sure that you don't have to jump through all these hoops. Make absolutely sure that they won't let you, maybe instead of rolling out the after-tax contributions to a Roth IRA, if you have a Roth 401k at work, if they'll allow you just to move the after-tax portion over to the Roth 401k. That would be a simpler step to ultimately getting that money out to the Roth IRA without rolling the kind of, they're essentially doing a form of a pro rata, or they're bringing along the associated earnings with your after-tax contributions that are sitting in the traditional, and that's what's causing this problem of you having to then shove back the before-tax portion into the 401k to pull this off. But make absolutely sure there's not a shorter path to your destination. I'd get back on the horn maybe one more time with Fidelity and see if there's a way to get the after-tax contributions that are in the traditional 401k over to a Roth. Fill in the blank. You asked them the question, I think, maybe of getting it out to the Roth IRA, but now you have this second step to deal with to do it cleanly. Make sure you can't, you know, it's an easier path maybe just to go over to the Roth 401k. And then from there, you could go out to the IRA ultimately. So just check. Maybe you can't, but I'm always in favor of simpler steps than when possible.
Okay. That's fair enough. And the reason she wants to do all this, listeners, in case you're saying, well, these dollar amounts are so small, is only $7,000. She does give a little bit of thought on that, because that was my first reaction, Chris. So you might have to pay some taxes on $7,000. She is getting very, very, very close, she said, to the NIT threshold. And she's worried any little bit of money, no matter how small it is, might push her into NIT. And she could get hit hard with NIT because of some sales she did. So anyways, that's why she's trying to keep that
makes sense.
Not subject to any taxes. One other thing which I thought was cute, and I do want to mention because it did make me go, She said, I'm one of your do-it-yourself listeners, but I'm not sure what you would call me. I have accounts at Fidelity, but I only buy Vanguard mutual funds.
A trader? I don't know.
A trader. So is she a Fidelian? Is she a Vanguardian? And I tried to find a cute way to put those two words together, and I can't.
That's a tough one. That one we might have to take some thought. She's definitely a hybrid. She's definitely, a lot of people do that, of course. I have seen that Vanguard inside of another custodial account. Certainly can happen, as is the case here. So I'm not sure what label we put on her. We'll think about that.
Okay. All righty. This next question is real interesting, too. So he begins, he's writing on behalf of his daughter. Okay. He gives his real name, but we'll call him George. And he says, I live in the Garden State. Mm-hmm. You know what the Garden State is?
New Jersey.
New Jersey. And he says, yes, there are gardeners in New Jersey. So,
well, it's not quite lush and green there.
It is. It's actually one of the best places to garden. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wouldn't want to do it in Princeton or something like that, but it is a good gardening state. I just, you couldn't pay me to live in Jersey, though, so it ain't going to happen. All right. Anyways, it says, great show. I really enjoy it. I hope this finds you in good health. So far, so good with my health and your health too, Chris. So we're happy to report that. He says, I have a 32-year-old single daughter. She works for a very large hospital system, and she maxes out both her 403B and her 457 plan with $39,000 pre-tax. Mm-hmm. She does not put 39,000 folks pre-tax into each account. She puts her allowable elective deferral, which is right now $19,500 a year. That's per person, not per plan. However, Chris, she has a 457. Why is her case unique?
Well, she's actually allowed to make a full deferral into the 457 as well. The 457 has its own limit, which is quite unique.
Quite unique. If she had two 403Bs, two 401Ks, which is what most people would have, even with different employers, you're still only allowed to defer on a pre-tax basis from your salary just $19,500. That is per person, not per plan. But 457 plans, as Chris points out all the time on the show, are unique, and they have their own $19,500 deferral limit.
Little note for 2022, going up by $1,000.
Yes.
Just came out.
That just came out. And just so people know, IRA contributions have not increased. Catch-up on IRAs have not increased. But 401Ks have increased $1,000. It'll be $20,500.
Yep.
Okay. He continues. She also does some consulting work and earns about $40,000 a year in 1099 income. Mm-hmm. Her business expenses are about $5,000. So she went ahead and has opened a solo 401k Roth, but she hasn't funded it yet. What we're wondering is, what will her limits be for the contribution into her solo 401k? Is she limited by the overall $58,000 a year that can be put into a 401k? I really hate to rain on their parade, but they're not going to be able to do what she's hoping to do. So let's kind of delve into this a little bit. And the reason I want to answer this now is they're running out of time with the year coming to an end shortly. So let's start looking at some of what she's dealing with here, folks. As Chris and I have already said, and that's the only info I have, Chris. So I have no other info on her situation.
So we don't know the split between the 403B and the 457?
I am assuming She is putting 39,000 equally into them, 19 and a half pre-tax into each one because she's allowed to. Mm. So I don't see any problem with what he's written, the first part of his email to us. He didn't break it down, but the only way she can be doing it is to put 19 and a half into the 401k, 19 and a half into the 457. Okay. The only reason she's getting away with it, folks, 457 plans just have that bizarre rule that their 19 and a half annual contribution limit does not apply to anything else. You can do that plus all the other 401ks or 403bs, which are limited. Normal people, if you don't have a 457, doesn't matter how many 401ks you have, you can work for five different companies with five different 401ks. You're still limited to just putting in 19,500 total between all five of them. But 457 has its own 19.5. So that's how the 39 comes up, I'm assuming. So what they're wondering is, hey, I make $40,000 1099 part-time consulting income. I have expenses of about $5,000. I went ahead and opened a solo 401k. A solo 401k, folks, is a regular 401k with some unique attributes. First, it's not an ERISA-protected plan. I want to make mention of that because of one key thing. I'm guessing this young woman is a physician. Otherwise, I'm not sure how she would have the salary. Or there could be hospital employees who make a lot of money to put $39,000 in and be looking to max out more money. I could be totally wrong. Maybe she's not a physician. The reason I mention it, Chris, a solo 401k, folks, is not an ERISA plan. So it does not receive the strong creditor protection that ERISA plans like her 403b and 457 will likely enjoy.
Well, that was bringing it up. May or may not, depending.
I was going to say, I don't know too much about those
government
plans.
Government-sponsored plans aren't necessarily ERISA protected. Different kinds of protections a lot of times, but may not be quite as clean as you're describing.
So I did want to make quick mention of that. The other issues are, so let's move on to that. We already talked how the 457 plan does have that separate 19,500, no problem. What is the problem she's going to run into here?
The 403B, the 19,500 she's got going there is essentially taking up her per taxpayer deferral limit. And she can't defer cleanly as an employee additional monies.
Correct. So one of the things that, so what I'm getting at, listener, you're hoping your daughter can put money into the Roth 401k. She can't. The 401k, the Roth part of the 401k, its ability to contribute has been maxed out by the 403b. You're only allowed one 19,500. She could put a profit share into
Yeah, you're heading the right direction. Go ahead.
She could put a profit share into the Roth part, but that's not going to quite work out. She's going to be limited on how much can go into that. He's trying to hope that she can put $58,000 in there. I don't see that working. So I started thinking, could she benefit from a simple or a SEP plan? She's not going to benefit from the simple because, this again, she ate up her $19,500 deferral limit. However, Chris, a SEP does not take employee contributions at all. It's all employer contributions. So the employer, her, on her self-employed side, can defer money in. But here's the problem. It's limited to 25% of compensation, But in her case, being self-employed and not a corporation, it is going to equate to about 20% of her adjusted net earnings. The father said she earns 40, her expenses are 5. So she's netting 35,000. She's going to be limited to 20% of that. That 20% of 35,000 is only going to allow her to put $7,000 into the SEP. And the SEP is not a Roth. The SEP is a traditional. Why? It's employer money. And employer money has to go into a traditional. And if she ever hires someone, whatever percent is she's putting in must be put in for the employee. So it should never be used if your daughter is going to someday hire someone on the consulting practice that she has. A better option to her in the future, if she is a physician, I don't know, and her consulting practice grows and she gets significantly more income in the future, $100,000, $150,000, $200,000, she should start looking at a defined benefit plan for that company where she would be able to defer a massive amount of her income into a defined benefit. I don't want to get too deep into that. So these are some of the issues. She can make a profit sharing into the solo 401k, but it will not go into the Roth.
Yeah, that was the other thing I wanted. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I was about to clarify that piece.
Yes. What I'm thinking of with all of this, she seems to be wanting to get money into a Roth. Why not find out or pester your employer to make the 403B or the 457 or both offer a Roth option?
Yep, I would check that first. Make sure there's not a Roth 457 choice there.
Or a Roth 403B choice. And put in the $39,000 as Roth. That seems to be what she wants to do. She's 32. I'm assuming making pretty good money if she can afford to put $39,000 away from her salary. I only can hazard what this young woman will be earning in 30 years, Chris, when she's 52. Your peak earnings are in your 50s. And who knows what her taxes will be in 30 years, her tax bracket and rates. So funding a Roth now makes total sense. Especially if they close Roths in the future, Chris, and won't allow any new ones, which is where I still think we're headed. No time soon, but I'm still thinking 8, 12, 15 years from now, you're going to, I personally do feel they'll go after Roths. So these are just the ideas going through my head, but she is not going to be able to put anything into the Roth as a contribution listener because she maxed it out already when she put $19,500 into her 403B.
Yep.
And the employer, her, could make a profit-sharing contribution, but it would have to go into the traditional pot of her solo 401K.
Right.
So that's the issues. I don't have any more info. But I think
if she has the right solo 401k, couldn't she, even though she does that profit sharing contribution, essentially from the employer side of her side business she's got going there, and have the solo 401k designed specifically to allow conversions? She could do that and then convert it, and she would have effectively gotten money into the Roth like she was trying to. That might be another way to look at it.
That very well may be. I'm not an expert enough in 401ks, but everything you just said makes total sense to me. The employer, her, puts a profit-sharing contribution into the traditional part of the 401k, and she has her 401k when she set it up, or she can amend it to allow for in-plan conversions. She could convert that. The tax liability is the same, and she can get some money into the Roth that way.
Yep.
So that definitely could work as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Anyways, I wanted to kind of iron all this out before she started putting money in. It's like she's got it all ready to go. She just hasn't put the money in yet. I wanted to kind of say, hey, well, wait a minute. She can't. But she may want to pester her hospital system to offer the Roth option on the 403B or the 457. And I, even though she may be making good money and paying a lot in taxes being a single woman, I would really recommend she tries to get money into a Roth now, because I don't know if you can in the future. And Lord only knows when her earnings rise. She's only 32 years old, Chris. Lord only knows in 30 years where her tax brackets will be, and if Roths are even going to be around and allowed in 30 years. Yeah. Okay. Do we have time for more or not?
I hate to say if you have a short one, because every time I say that, you say you do, and then it's 20 more minutes. But
this one's short. Kind of short, and kind of ties into what we just said.
Okay, let's tackle that one then.
This guy is, it's cute. He's going to call himself George, but he's from Georgetown, Massachusetts.
Oh.
Yeah, I thought that was cute.
Okay. Perfect.
His real name is something else, folks, but he lives in Georgetown. Mm-hmm. So he says, hi, this is George from Georgetown, Mass. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the outstanding information and very entertaining podcast. I have a question about qualified retirement plans. I have assets in a self-funded Roth IRA. I have a rollover Roth IRA that contains money from an employer-sponsored 401k. And I still have a Roth 401k. He says, as you can probably tell, I don't want to deal with RMDs from the Roth 401k. So I'm considering rolling funds out of the Roth 401k. I am no longer employed at this company. And I will put those dollars into a rollover Roth IRA. I'm wondering how much legal protection will I lose moving these funds from a Roth 401k ERISA protected plan into a Roth IRA. Okay. I do want to point out to him, he does mention, Chris, that he already has that. He said he has a rollover Roth IRA from an employer-sponsored 401k. So he's already done that once. Maybe he's wondering what would happen, but he already did it once. What would happen again? Here it is again, folks. We talk about this a lot. The best creditor protection from bankruptcy and general non-bankruptcy creditors. So even though we say there's bankruptcy creditors and there's general creditors, they're two different types of creditors. There's the, I have no more money, so I'm going to declare bankruptcy, and everybody I owe money to can fight it out in bankruptcy court. So there's those creditors. And then there's the creditors because you were driving down the road and you caused an accident, or someone's at your house and they trip and fall and bang their head and suffer some medical issues. They're going to blame you because they tripped and fell on your property. There's those types of creditors. So what are you going to give up? Inside an ERISA protected plan, you get phenomenal bankruptcy protection and you get phenomenal general creditor protection. When you move money from an ERISA 401k into an IRA, that money will always maintain its ERISA protected bankruptcy. Now, if you put it into a separate IRA, it's easy to track. If you mix it with your existing Roth IRA, it might be a little more difficult to track. But that money will continue to enjoy ERISA bankruptcy protection. The federal government also gives contributory IRAs bankruptcy protection, but they cap it at about $1.3 million in contributions and growth. However, Ed Slott points out all the time, even if you put the maximum amount in, Chris, with the maximum catch-up, since IRAs were created back in the 70s, you still would have only put in like $178,000. So for it to be worth $1.3 million or more, It would be almost impossible. So the point is, IRAs pretty much enjoy, contributory IRAs, enjoy really good bankruptcy protection. Mm-hmm. And that $1.3 million is not reduced by money that moved from an ERISA plan. That money also has its own bankruptcy protection.
Right.
The IRA, though, you may or may not have creditor protection, and it is going to depend on your state. I lived in Massachusetts, but that was 23 years ago. I don't know what the state of Massachusetts offers IRAs as far as general creditor protection. So if this truly is a concern of yours, I would speak with an attorney who's from Massachusetts that would hopefully know. Pretty much any estate planning attorney in any state that they're practicing in will know the bankruptcy protection on IRAs. So if you have an estate planning attorney already who pulled a will together for you or a power of attorney, give him or her a call and ask them, hey, what does Massachusetts give IRAs as far as general creditor protection? If it's strong, you might want to consider it. If you're asking this question, it might be because he's worried about general creditors, Chris. Mm-hmm. So I would really make sure before you move the money.
Yep.
Anything else you want to add?
No. That you touched on all the things I was thinking about as you read that. So I think we're good to go. That was, in fact, a fairly short one. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. See, I can do it. I can be pithy. All righty.
Well, we want to thank everybody for listening to another show. Thank you for coming back from Ohio and doing the show. It's always good.
You didn't think I was going to come back. You didn't even know I was gone, apparently.
Well, the days you were driving, you couldn't be on the show. You know, we had to, although it was nice having Bob on the show.
Yes. And did you, I don't know what you guys did when I wasn't here. On the EDU, did you do that question that I forwarded Bob?
I believe that's what we use as a form, as the template for that, because there was a lot going on.
Yeah, that was, I told you, there was a lot going on in that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
So worked,
I was wondering.
Worked well. I think it's nice to, you just kind of have to stage these disappearances so that it's about time for another review of tax issues.
That works
perfectly. So maybe another 90 days or so.
Yeah, leave for Kentucky and Ohio when it's time for Bob to come back on the show is what you say.
Yeah, that'll be the triggering event when we have enough questions for Bob, and then you can go again.
Well, I won't be going at all during the winter. Everybody says it's not very nice, so I can't see going out there in the winter.
You don't
maybe in the spring.
Experience it all year round so you know what you're getting into?
Not until I get my own apartment there and I can leave my old Subaru there and fly. I don't want to deal with driving.
And your insulated camo you can leave out there.
Yeah, all my insulated camo. I don't want to drive cross country during the wintertime. So, No, I won't go.
Okay.
All righty.
Well, thanks everybody for listening. If you have a question for the Q&A show or a suggestion for our EDU show, just go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com. On there is a contact form you can fill out, send in your question or comments. You can also email Jim directly, be best in the subject line if you indicate it's a question for the podcast, something like that, so it's easy for him to find. But you can email him directly at jim@jimhelps.com. So thanks, everybody. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.